Now, let's take a look at super successes in the culture, and let's look for common patterns. In the beginning of this program, I said I've always been interested in the differences in people, why some people succeed under the most dire and difficult circumstances, while others barely get by and feel unhappy when they're surrounded by success emotionally, socially, spiritually, and physiologically. What I'm also interested in is what creates a super success? What creates a champion? What is it that a Steven Spielberg and a Bruce Springsteen share in common that allow them to affect the culture in such a massively positive way? What is it that gave Kennedy and King the power to transform so many lives, both emotionally and behaviorally? What is it that makes a Pete Rose and a Ronald Reagan unique? What is it that a Tina Turner and a Ted Turner share in terms of characteristics? Because my experience has shown that success leaves clues. That is, people who succeed do certain things over and over and over again. And if you find out what people do in their minds and in their bodies that creates for them high peak emotional states and effective behaviors, if you take the same actions mentally and physically, you'll produce the same results. I call that process modeling. And NLP taught me to model people with more precision than ever before. I found out how to do exactly what they were doing in their head to produce a result.
For example, I went to the United States Army, and I went to a general there. And I said, "General, I can take anything that you're teaching presently in the entire Army, any training program, and I can cut the training time in half, and I can increase the competency simultaneously." He went, "You're crazy." I said, "No, sir, I'm expensive." We worked out a deal where he would give me projects he thought were impossible. That is, they could not be improved upon. I would cut them in half. If I cut them in half and increased the competency, I would be paid. If I didn't, I would not. The Army had nothing to lose. I had everything to lose if I didn't produce the result, and everything to gain if I did. So sure enough, we put this project together, and I went to work on the project. And I thought they'd give me like a 6-month training program, right? I figured, God, there'd be these holes in here, and I'd find them. They gave me a 4-day training program. They also gave me a product I was not excited about, pistol shooting. I mean, I didn't go to the Army to enhance the Army's ability to kill people. I went to the Army because I knew by using these skills, I could affect the thinking processes of various people simultaneously who were decision makers about what our choices are and how to handle aggression and look at our world. And I was looking to be able to have that kind of rapport and that kind of connection. So they give me this project I'm not thrilled about, and they say, "Look, we have a 4-day pistol shooting program. Here in our division, it takes 4 days to do it, and we can only qualify 70% of the people, which means 30% fail every single time in their program." I said, "Great, I'll cut it in half and I'll increase the competency." They said, "Great, we'll introduce you to the pistol coach." I said, "No, I don't want to talk to him. I want to talk to the best shooters in the world. You bring me the best shooters, I'll find out what makes them best, and we'll teach that." So they gave me the number one shooter in the Army, the national shooter, and their pistol shooting coach. They all come down to meet me. I'm down this underground shooting range. Here I am, I'm in a t-shirt, a pair of jeans, because I know I'm just going to be kicking back that day. Look, Cuddy Young. So sure enough, these guys walk in and they go, "Where's the teacher?" And I go, "I'm him." They go, "Ha ha ha, where's the teacher?" I said, "I'm him." Now bear in mind, these guys have been shooting 20 and 24 years respectively. I was 24 years old at the time. They said, "How many years you been shooting guns?" I said, "Well, I've never shot a gun before, but it should be fun." Now they laugh and say, "You're joking." I said, "No, I'm not joking." They said, "You're gonna teach us?" I said, "Yes, I don't have to know all the stuff about shooting first. I first have to know your beliefs." They go, "Beliefs have nothing to do with shooting." I said, "It has more to do with it than you realize." They go, "Let's see you shoot." I said, "Look, I don't know how yet." They said, "Let's see you shoot." I said, "Fine, give me a gun." I said, "Show me how to load it." They go, "Show you how to load it?" So they show me how to load it. I pointed at them. They didn't like that. I go to fire the gun. I don't like guns. I'm kind of shaking like this, and I'm shooting a .45 caliber pistol, which if you ever shot one, has a kick to it, right? So I'm shaking like this, boom! The thing kicks back, and I put the bullet up in the ceiling, not anywhere near the target. These guys would have left if they could have, but they were on orders. So I said, "Look, let me sit down and find out your beliefs." So I went through a process on how to elicit the key belief systems that someone has. And I found that these shooters, the best shooters in the nation, had 32 specific beliefs about shooting that were totally different than the people I interviewed who could not pass the class. So what did I do? I took their 32 beliefs about shooting and instilled them within myself, literally installed them, if you will, inside my own belief structures. So the bottom line is I put those beliefs in, and then I moved on to the second key to duplicating excellence, and jot down what number two is. The second key to duplicating any form of human excellence is called duplicate the person's mental syntax. Syntax sounds like a complicated word. It's actually very simple. I'll give you an example of syntax. If I say to you, the dog bit Johnny, you all know what that means, right? Of course, no problem. What if I say, Johnny bit the dog? Different experience, isn't it? Especially if you're Johnny or the dog. Now, what did I do? Did I add or subtract words? Absolutely not. All I did was change the what? The order and sequence, also known as the what?
Syntax.
By changing the syntax of words or even the way you use your nervous system, you absolutely instantly change the meaning and the result. For example, we all have five senses. The order in which we use those five senses determines the kind and quality of results that we produce. For example, in order to spell effectively, you use various aspects of your five senses, don't you? If you want to spell a word. Some people are excellent spellers, some are poor spellers. The difference is the syntax of whether they visualize the word or sound the word out first or try to feel it out first, and the order in which these do things make all the difference. For example, how many of you are really great spellers? Let me see a show of hands. Really great. How many of you are really lousy spellers? Raise your hand and tell the truth. Now, let me ask you a question. If you're a bad speller, tell me the truth, yes or no. If you're a bad speller, does that mean you're less intelligent than a good speller? Yes or no?
No.
Bad spellers always say no. Which is true, by the way, okay? Because spelling has nothing to do with intelligence. Intelligence has a great deal to do with syntax, the order and sequence in which you use pictures, sounds, feelings within yourself. And we're going to study this in great detail and show you how you can find out your syntax that causes you to be motivated. There's a syntax that causes you to fall in love, a syntax of pictures, sounds, and feelings. And once you understand the syntax, it's like a code. And you can punch in that code anytime, and your body will go into that same state consistently. All I did was take that syntax, record it, install it in myself. Then I moved on to the final, the third key to duplicating any form of human excellence. And the third key is duplicate a person's physiology. Physiology, posture, breathing pattern, muscle tension or relaxation. How you use your body determines what portion of your brain you're using. See, when people are depressed, don't they take on a specific physiology? Think of a depressed person, what are they? Slumped shoulders, what are their eyes? Down, breathing is what? Shallow, right? And if you put yourself in the same physiology, you'll feel the same way. People that are vibrant, energized, they have a different posture, a different breathing pattern. In fact, this is so powerful that when you duplicate someone's physiology, if you do it exactly, identically, as they are using their nervous system, if you duplicate them, then what happens is you start firing off the same messages in your brain as they're firing off in theirs. So let's say a man comes along, spends 10 years of his life to discover the key way to run his mind and body to produce some unique result. If you come in and duplicate his physiology, you don't have to go through all the trial and error. You start running your brain the same way he is running his brain, right away. That's incredible, because if you start using your nervous system the same way he uses his, you'll start producing similar results. If you sow the same seeds, you'll reap the same rewards. Now, it is so powerful. I know this sounds a little bit like, you know, ABC. Oh, could it really be that simple? You bet it is. That's the power of duplicating physiology. So what I do with these shooters, they've spent 20 years adjusting their body in every way, right, to finally they found a physiology that assists them in being in the optimum state for shooting a 45 caliber gun effectively. So I don't have to go through the trial and error, I just model their physiology, find out what part of the physiology is critical versus what part's idiosyncratic, and then model it. That is duplicated in myself. Well, what's the result? Well, I take what I've learned, the key beliefs, the mental syntax, the strategy they're using, and the physiology, and I put them into a training program where I take new recruits, and in one day, before they ever touch a gun, I install the beliefs, the same beliefs these guys have. I install the same strategy, even though they never shot a gun. I install the same physiology before they ever pick up a gun. Now we finally give them a gun, and all of a sudden, guess what? In a day and a morning, we qualify 100% of the people on my program instead of 70% with the Army. 100%. Not only that, we tripled the number of people that qualified at the highest level called expert. In other words, they only get so many in 4 days to become expert. We tripled the number it took them 4 days to do in a day and a morning. Incredible. The colonel who was the head of the project wrote the general and said it was the first breakthrough in pistol shooting since World War I. Now the purpose of this is not for you to go, wow, isn't Robbins a great modeler? The purpose is that I want you to leave here this weekend, this 4 day period of time, realizing that who could have done what I did there? Who? Who? You. As long as you duplicated those people's, number one, they're what? Number two, they're? And number three, they're? See, that's my goal for you. My goal is you leave here, and when you see somebody do something that's outstanding, instead of going, wow, aren't they great? You go, wow, aren't they great? And if I want to do that, I'm willing to commit some time and some energy, then I can do it too if I duplicate beliefs, syntax, and physiology. And that's been the reality that I've experienced in training. Even things that seem to be impossible to me, I've been able to do that with. And you'll find the same for yourself. That's what modeling is all about. And in this tape program, you're going to learn how to model with more precision than ever before, because you're going to learn how to find out what people are doing in their head more precisely than maybe even they knew in their past. By the way, as a gift, I took these three shooters who I'd been modeling and taught them the best of what they knew from each other. I trained them in 1 hour. Each of them improved their score. The best pistol shooter in the nation at that time scored higher than he had in 6 months after 1 hour of instruction from me, a guy who'd never shot a gun before. The second man I trained with shot more bullseyes than ever in his career. And the coach, who was also there, gave both of his men a run for the money. The point is, whether someone has a successful relationship, whether they are effective in motivating their children, whether effective in eating in a way that keeps themselves slim and trim and healthy, whatever a human being does, there is a way to model it. All you have to do is find out what they're doing and do the same things. So in that light, let's look at some general belief systems or characteristics that champions seem to share in common. I call these the 7 fundamental character traits of a champion. These are the 7 things that cause people who succeed on a massive scale to consistently take action and do whatever is necessary to produce the results that they want in their life. And let's just go through them quickly. Trait number 1 is passion. All of these people have discovered a reason, a consuming, energizing, almost obsessive purpose that drives them to do, to grow, and to be more. It gives them the fuel that powers their success train and causes them to tap their true potential. It's passion that causes a Pete Rose to continuously dive headfirst into second base as if he was still a rookie playing in his first major league game. It's passion that sets the actions of Lee Iacocca apart from so many others. It's passion that drives the computer scientists through years of dedication to create the kind of breakthroughs that have put men and women in outer space and brought them back again. It's passion that causes people to stay up late and get up early. It's passion that people want in their relationships. Passion gives life power and juice and meaning. There is no greatness without a passion to be great. Whether it's the aspiration of an athlete, an artist, a scientist, a parent, or a businessman, we all discover that the key to our success is to find something that mobilizes us, something that gives us an obsessive desire to use and be all we can be and to do all that we can do to create our lives exactly as we envision it. Where do we get a passion? Well, we're going to talk about that when we talk about the power of goal setting. But just for now, realize one of the ways that you can develop a passion is get around where it's better and let something hit you. Surround yourself with passionate people, and you'll begin to discover that something will grab you, something will magnify your desires, something can capture you. But you've got to try many things. You've got to attempt many things. Does Spielberg have a passion for movie making? You bet. It's more than a job. It's a career. It's a lifestyle. And that is what envisions him to take action day after day, no matter what happens around him. Trait number 2. Belief. Every religious book on the planet talks about the power and the effect of faith and belief on mankind. People who succeed on a major scale differ greatly in their beliefs from those people who fail. Our beliefs about what we are and what we can be precisely determine what we will be. If we believe in magic, we'll live a magical life. If we believe our life is defined by narrow limits, then we've suddenly made those limits real. What we believe to be true, what we believe is possible, becomes what's true. It becomes what's possible. This set of tapes will teach you specific scientific ways to quickly change your beliefs so that they support you in the attainment of your most desired goals rather than limiting you. You know, many people are passionate, but because of their limiting beliefs about who they are and what they can do, they never take the actions that could make their dreams into a reality. People who succeed know what they want and believe they can get it. Now, passion and belief help to provide the fuel, the propulsion, if you will, that pushes us toward excellence. But propulsion's not enough. If it were, it'd be enough to fuel a rocket and send it flying blindly toward the heavens. Besides the power, we need a path. We need an intelligent sense of logical progression. To succeed in hitting a target, we need trait number 3, a strategy. A strategy is a way of organizing our resources.
When Steven Spielberg decided to become a filmmaker, he mapped out a course that would lead to the world that he wanted to conquer. He figured out what he wanted to learn, whom he needed to know, what he needed to do. He had a passion, yes, he had a belief, but he also had a strategy that would make those things work to their greatest potential. Every great entertainer, politician, parent, or employer knows that it's not enough to have the resources to succeed. One must use those resources in the most effective way. A strategy is a recognition that the best talents and ambitions also need to find the right avenue. You can open a door by breaking it down, or you can find the key that opens it intact. In this tape program, we're going to learn how to model the most effective strategies of others. Trait number 4, clarity of values. When we think of things that made America great, we think of things like patriotism and pride, a sense of tolerance, and a love of freedom. These things are values, the fundamental, ethical, moral, and practical judgments we make about what's most important, what really matters in our lives. Values are simply specific belief systems that we have about what is right and wrong for our lives. They're the judgments we make about what makes life worth living. Many people don't have a clear idea of what's most important to them in their lives. Many times people do things in their lives, and then afterwards they're very unhappy with themselves. They have internal conflict. And the reason is because, although they're taking actions on one level, there's a part of them that doesn't believe what they're doing is right. When we look at the great successes, they're almost always people with a clear, fundamental sense about what really matters. I mean, think of the Ronald Reagans, the John F. Kennedys, the Martin Luther Kings, the John Waynes, the Jane Fondas, the Gandhis, the Bill Cosbys. They all have different visions. But what they have in common is a fundamental moral grounding, a sense of who they are and why they do what they do. An understanding of values is one of the most rewarding and challenging keys to achieving success, and one we'll definitely investigate in this tape program. As you've probably noticed, all these traits feed on and interact with one another. Is passion affected by our beliefs? Of course it is. The more we believe we can accomplish something, the more we're usually willing to invest in its achievement. Is belief by itself enough to achieve excellence? Well, hey, it's a good start. But if you believe you're going to see a sunrise and your strategy for achieving that goal is to begin running west, then you're going to have some problems. Are our strategies for success affected by our values? You bet. If your strategy for success requires you to do things that don't fit your unconscious beliefs about what is right or wrong for your life, then even the best strategy won't work. This is often seen in individuals who begin to succeed only to end up sabotaging their own success. The problem is there's an internal conflict between what the individual values most internally and their strategy for achieving external success. All 4 of the things we've already considered are inseparable from trait number 5, energy. You must have a thing called energy. Energy! Energy is the source. Nothing happens without energy. And the more of it you have, the more of your personal potential you're going to tap into. But see, energy is like the gas that drives the car of success. And you don't want to run out of emotional gas when you're climbing the hill of success. Otherwise, you'll find yourself coasting back downhill. And that's what happens to a lot of people. How many of you, for example, can remember a day when you woke up feeling really tired and lethargic? How many can remember a day like that? For some of you, it was recent. Now, when you wake up feeling like really tired and lethargic, do you usually jump up and go, God, I can't wait to go out, change the world, help people, help my own self, change everything that's happening in this world so it's better? Is that usually what you do when you wake up feeling lethargic? Not usually the first thought, is it? Right? First thought's, where's the coffee? Next thought is, oh God, not another Monday. You know, when I came here to New York, I got an education. I first started coming here about 2 years ago. And I remember about my third trip in, I came on a Wednesday, and you know, midweek, and I'm sitting in the back of the car here, right? And I turn on the stereo. And I'm kicking back, just enjoying the music, and after the song is over, the DJ comes on, and he goes, all right out there, ladies and gentlemen, we made it, it's hump day. Do you know what hump day is? Wednesday. Yeah, some people look at Wednesday as hump day, which means you're over the hump. You're more than half the way to the weekend. Can you imagine that large numbers of people spend 5 days out of every 7 looking forward to only 2 of them? Some people live for 2 days out of every 7. Can you imagine living that way, having such a boring, disgusting life that you look forward to 2 out of 7? Hey, you know what's worse? In California,
there is a new club that's formed. They call it the Thank God It's Fridays Club. It's a group of people that look forward to one day out of seven. Right? Can you imagine? And you know what these people who look forward to the weekend do on those 2 days? They do things to their mind and body so that on Monday they can't even remember what happened on those 2 days. I mean, that's what they do with these days they look forward to. They're like, what'd you do this week? Oh, shit, can't even remember. See, the bottom line is my Mondays are better than most people's Christmases because I've learned how to communicate to myself. See, in a way where I can find the passion and I've got something I'm working towards and for. And I've also, most importantly, got the physical energy to make it happen. Because without that, we get caught in the trap of making a living instead of designing a life. And that's an ugly trap to get into. You know what I'm talking about? Well, you have so little energy that you go to work, you fight the traffic home, you watch a little TV, get a bite to eat, say hello to your lover or husband or wife, and get to bed. To wake up in the morning to start the same old thing all over again. And you know what's really sad? A lot of the people that live this way are incredibly intelligent. They're incredibly committed human beings. They really have a vision for themselves and for the world, but you know what they're really missing? Energy. They don't have enough physical vibrancy to tap who they are. And as a result, they get caught in the trap where at the end of their life, they discover they've lived 1/10 of it, all because they didn't have enough energy. I can't think of anything that's more important to get you to take action daily than to have that sense of physical abundance, of energy abundance. How many of you can remember a day when you had that incredible vibrancy from the moment you woke up, you had that energy? How many of you can remember a day like that? On a day like that, remember how you felt? On a day like that, were you not in a position where you tapped more of your potential? How many found that that was true? You bet. Not only did you tap more of your potential, but even the challenges of life affect you differently, don't they? When you're vibrant and something happens that normally wipes you out, you have a different sense about it. You still have a sense of possibility because there are resources available there in your emotion, in your body. It's available. See, I remember Vince Lombardi. Remember him, the great Green Bay Packer coach? He used to have a great phrase. He said, fatigue makes cowards of us all. See, if you're tired, that's the first thing that make you feel like, ugh, I don't even feel like trying. Sometimes the failure to try is physical, right? You wake up in the morning, your mind says, let's go get them, and your body says, I can't even get out of bed. You know? The Bible phrase that says, sometimes the spirit is willing and the flesh is weak. Yeah, you don't want to be in that place. You want to have the congruency of knowing that your mind and your body are one. And one of the ways to create that congruency is to make sure you have physical vibrancy. Physical energy. Remember, energy is the fuel that drives your success train, and you don't want to run out of emotional gas when you're climbing the hill of success. Trait number 6, bonding power. Nearly all successful people I've studied have in common an extraordinary ability to bond with others. The ability to connect with and develop deep rapport with people from a variety of backgrounds and beliefs. Sure, you know, there's the occasional mad genius who invents something that changes the world. But if the genius spends all his time in a lonely warren, he'll succeed on one level but fail on many others. The great successes of our culture and our world all have the ability to form bonds that unite them with millions of others. And of course, the greatest success is not on the stage of the world. It's in the deepest recesses of your own heart. I mean, deep down, everyone needs to form lasting, loving bonds with others. Without that, any success, any excellence is hollow indeed. We all want that sense of connection with people that we meet. And bonding power is a skill that anyone can develop, one that will allow you to tap higher levels of success than you may have ever imagined before. The final trait, trait number 7, mastery of communication. This is the essence of everything, of course, that we've talked about so far and everything we'll be talking about in the future. The way we communicate with others and the way we communicate with ourselves ultimately determines the quality of our lives. People who succeed in life are those who have learned how to take any challenge that life gives them and communicate that experience to themselves in a way that causes them to successfully change. People who fail take the adversities of life and accept them as limitations. The people who shape our lives and our cultures are also masters of communication to others. What they have in common is an ability to communicate a vision or a quest or a joy or a mission.
Mastery of communication is what makes a great parent, a great artist, or a great politician, or a great teacher. Everything in this tape program will be directed towards teaching you how to more effectively communicate to yourself or to others to produce new emotions and new behaviors. So as we review these 7 character traits, how many of them are you experiencing in your life right now? Do you have that passionate desire for something? Do you believe you can really make it happen? Have you developed a strategy yet to make your goals a reality? Are you really clear on your values and what's most important to you in life? Do you have the energy that will be necessary to produce the results that you want? Do you have the ability to meet anyone in a few moments, bond with them, and have them feel responsive to you, develop that sense of rapport? Have you mastered the way you communicate to yourself so that you take action instead of being immobilized? Have you learned to communicate to other people in a way that emboldens them to action? Most of us would have to say that we have some of these in alignment, but not all. This tape program is designed for us to learn how to install them all in ourselves. But first, just take a moment and look back at these 7 character traits and see if you believe they really do make a difference. Think of someone that you know personally who's successful. Maybe the top salesman in your office. Maybe a business person. Are they passionate? Do they have incredible beliefs that are different than maybe the ones you've held in the past? What kind of strategy have they developed? Run through the list, and I think you'll find that these character traits are consistent with people who succeed on a large scale. I can tell you several examples, one of which would be Steven Spielberg. I mean, a lot of times when people see someone who's succeeding again, they think, wow, what a gifted young man. What a lucky man he was to have all this creativity. But in reality, we can all develop creativity if we're passionate enough about something. Steven Spielberg is where he is today, not because someone gave him a gift, but because he was passionate, he believed, he developed a strategy, he was clear on what was most important to him, he had the energy to follow through, he developed rapport, and he mastered communication, both to himself and to others in the form of movies.
Why is Steven Spielberg this great, successful man? Because he had this tremendous creativity and genius. That genius was developed by practicing his craft day after day. He's known he wanted to be involved with movies. He's had a love for movies since he was 13 years old. When he was 17 years old, he decided to go on the Universal Studios tour in California, and he went on the tram and got real bored real fast. He said, I want to see real movies. So he had a thing called personal what? So he got himself to take action. He snuck away from the tram, and he got down to the movie lot, and he actually stepped onto a filming and actually watched some filming going on. He wasn't supposed to be there. But he also had a tool called rapport. He developed rapport with a director and started talking with this man. And this guy liked this moxie little kid, you know, young kid, right, who seemed to have this real desire, and he loved the creativity and the intensity that he saw in this young man. And so he told him about what it was like to be a producer and a director, and told him it was the greatest career he could ever have, and he should do whatever it took to become one. And then finally the man said, okay, now it's time for you to go, and the security escorted him off the lot. Now for most people, that would have been, God, what a neat story, huh? You know, you're 17, you get to meet a real director, watch a real filming instead of just going on the tour. But see, once again, this man was totally committed to a dream. And so guess what? Using his personal what?
Power,
he took action. And the next day, he came up with a plan. He showed up at the Universal's lot wearing this one suit that he owned and borrowed his dad's old briefcase, threw in there a candy bar and a couple sandwiches, and he walked by purposely, congruently past the guard and went, hey, how's it going, Harry? Of course, he got the guy's name by reading his name tag. But he was so congruent that Harry just went, hi, and he walked right on by. So now he's in the lot where he now goes around meeting people, watching movies, learning, right? Knowing his outcome, taking action, getting some sensory cueing, learning what worked and what didn't work in movie making. And he went there every day after school and throughout the summer. So people began, the guard would say, Harry would say, hey, how's it going, Steven? How are your movies coming? Hey, great, it's really fabulous. He found himself an abandoned trailer. There are lots of them on Universal Studios lot. He found one, cleaned it out, got some plastic letters. On the outside he wrote, Steven Spielberg, director. People say, where's your office? He's over there at, you know, K9 and everything else. People come to his office. One day, finally, a director said to him, well, let's see one of your movies. So he pops out this Super 8 cartridge. He said, well, wait, we got to see a real movie. He said, you know, you seem to know a lot about that. How did you learn so much about movies? Well, he spent 2 years or a year on the lot, right? Being there, developing acuity, developing and stuff, getting creative, letting his mind run, totally committed to his outcome. So finally he said, look, if you'll make a film and show it to us, a short film, he said, we may hire you. So he went out and convinced one of his friends, who was in my seminar last week, and I told the story, and this guy got up and said, I financed that original film. It took $10,000, and Steven Spielberg made this little film about a group of teenagers that went from the desert and hitchhiked to California. And this guy financed it. It was amazing. Anyway, bottom line is, he showed up to Universal Studios, and they hired him with a 7-year contract to make television programs.
not bad. Why was he there? Because he had this great gift. His great gift was commitment to an outcome you'd do whatever it took. And out of his personal power, he took action until he found a way to make it work. That's where the power is. Commitment to practice what is important to you, to do whatever it takes, and not to accept less than you can be. Not to accept results that are less than you deserve or anyone that you support or represent. That's critical.
One of my favorite examples of personal power and these fundamental character traits making the difference in the quality of life is the story of Honda International. Honda is now a company that's doing $11 billion in sales. They're the largest manufacturer of motorbikes in the world. How'd they get started? Well, there was a man named Honda who had a passion, a desire. He was so passionate about his goal that in 1938, he took all of his money, everything he owned, and invested it in a little workshop where he began to work on piston rings, something he wanted to sell to Toyota Corporation at the time. He worked day and night, sleeping there, never leaving, always believing he could produce the result. He was up to his elbows in grease. He even pawned his wife's jewelry in order to stay in business. After completing his piston rings and trying to sell it to Toyota, Toyota turned him down, said that the piston ring didn't meet their standards. He went back to school for 2 years, where he got to hear laughter from his instructors and fellow students as they looked at his designs as being absurd. But at the end of 2 years, his designs brought results because he knew what he wanted, he took action, he learned from each effort, and he kept changing his approach till he got what he wanted. Toyota said, "Fine, you have a contract." He was ecstatic. He was excited. His passion and his belief had paid off. But then a new problem came about. The Japanese government was tooling for war, and they refused to give him the concrete that would be necessary to build his factory. Did he quit here? Of course not. He just developed another strategy. He used his bonding and rapport tools to get a series of men to work with him to learn a new process for creating his own concrete, and he built his own factory. During the war, his factory was bombed twice, destroying major portions of his manufacturing facility. Rather than being depressed about the destruction of his factories, he would just immediately rush out, grab his men, and pick up all the extra gasoline cans that the U.S. fighters threw away. He called them gifts from President Truman because they provided him with the raw materials needed for his manufacturing process. Finally, after all of this, an earthquake leveled his factory, and Honda finally decided to sell his piston operation to Toyota. Now, here's a man who had passion, here's a man who had belief, here's a man who had strategy, here's a man who was totally clear about what was most important in his life, here's a man who had almost unending energy. Here's a man who had tremendous rapport with other people, and here's a man who managed, through all of this, to continue to communicate to himself and other people in a way that kept him going, kept him succeeding. And yet still he'd not produced the ultimate result that he wanted. The result was to come later, after several other attempts at manufacturing concerns in which he failed. Finally, in 1947, a tremendous gasoline shortage in Japan occurred after the war, and Honda couldn't even use his car to go get food for his family. Finally, in desperation, he attached a small motor to his bicycle. The next thing he knew, a neighbor asked him if he'd make him one, and then another, and then another, and another, until finally he ran out of motors. Finally, he decided he ought to get into building motors, and he started a little manufacturing concern doing that. His challenges weren't up yet, but for a passionate man who believes and who can develop strategy, he found a way around the next challenge, which was the Japanese government. The Japanese government had developed laws to limit the use of gasoline. So in order to be able to power his motorbikes, Honda developed a strategy of running them on pine resin. He would squeeze the resin out of pine and mix it with gasoline he bought on the black market. This created a turpentine-like smell, which allowed him to travel without the Japanese government being upset. They knew it wasn't gasoline he was using. How did he finally take it to the largest level? Did he get someone to give him a large amount of money? No, that was strategy also. He had a strategy where he used his rapport skills to appeal to the values of 18,000 bicycle shop owners. He wrote them a letter stating his dream for a revitalized Japan through the new mobility that motorbikes could provide. And he talked to them about how they could play a role in making a difference in the country as a whole. And he got 5,000 of those 18,000 to sign up and help advance the capital necessary to go into business. Still, only the hardcore bicycle fans bought these motorbikes. They were too big. So he made another adjustment. He always knew his outcome. He always took action. He always learned from what he was getting, and he changed his approach. He created a scaled-down motorbike he called the Cub. It became a quote-unquote overnight success, and Mr. Honda was given the Emperor's Award. He later began to import these motorbikes to the baby boomers of Europe and the United States, and finally followed that up in the 70s with the cars. Today, Honda Corporation employs over 100,000 people in both the United States and Japan, and it is here today and succeeds today because of the passion, the beliefs, the strategy, the values, the energy, the bonding power, and the mastery of communication of a man named Honda. These tools work. These are the fundamental beginnings. Now let's figure out how to enlist them, how to direct our own brain.